This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org. Talk.
How many of you have ever gone to a gravesite, for example, the gravesite of President Kennedy in the National Cemetery in Washington, D.C.? Okay, good. Did you pray there? Did you ask him, his soul, for any kind of succor or assistance or aid?
No, he's Catholic.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think I would get many hands. And I thought what Chuck said in the sermon this morning about the enchantment and medieval enchantment, he was talking about Archbishop Beckett, was important, because what I want to talk about today is the enchantment that the first century Jews lived in, the enchanted world they lived in, which is very similar to the medieval world in some ways. It's very different from our world. That you didn't, those of you who have been to President Kennedy's gravesite in the National Cemetery, didn't pray there, tells you how different you are and how you view things in your religious life from how ancient Jews did. And out of that difference comes Mary. Because Mary was an important figure in the early church. She was a matron of the early church. She was, before she died, and she was probably, and I get this from just senses knowing how things worked then, she was a source of sort of she was a mentress to many in the early church. You get that from the way Luke describes her role in the first chapter in Acts. And that's about the only real reference we have to her that's of any meaning and gives it a meaning in the sense that it gives any real definition of what she was really like as a person. The stories in Luke and Matthew are different, and I'll get to that later on, but what I want to begin with is that aspect of her life and why she becomes very early on the source of Christian believers' attention and devotion. And that's a paradox. If Jesus is a central figure in the New Testament to which we figure who saves us, the figure who, to whom is a mediator who intercedes for us with the Father, is a figure through whom we pray to God, why Mary? Anybody have any answer to that? I didn't expect you would, because that's what this is about. And I want to tell you how I finally got into this. Marty and I began teaching this course. We taught it here before. A longer series of actually 6 weeks of this, about 25, 30 years ago. And it always, in my gut, there was always this question I had, why Mary? When those questions arise, if Jesus is the central figure, why do Christians pray to Mary? Why do Christians revere Mary? Doesn't that seem somewhat inconsistent? Well, Protestants said it was. That's why you don't see Protestants particularly having any kind of reverence of Mary. So the question is, why do Catholics? Well, the Protestants broke a tradition 500 plus years ago that had been in the early church, the church from the beginning until the 16th century, of reverence for Mary. She's as reverenced by the Orthodox Church as she is by the Roman Catholics and some Anglicans. So why? Well, that's what we're going to try to figure out today. And the answer to that in brief is Jewish folk religion. Now, probably you've never heard of this at all. Jewish folk religion, like folk religion generally, is a way of coping with reality, a lived reality. And usually for people in the first century, if they were ordinary Jews, that reality is pretty harsh. we debate and argue and fuss about medical health care in this society, but if you live in the first century in the villages in what is now the West Bank and Israel, you didn't have any health care at all. There were no doctors around. The wealthy had doctors, but you didn't have doctors. You died. And people in that period typically thought of themselves as being oppressed by malign forces like demons. Demons cause illness. They cause mental illness. They also cause break in personal relationships. As Chuck was saying in a sermon, if your cow got sick, it was because some demon caused the illness of the cow. It wasn't because it was a bacteria or a virus. So the point I'm trying to make here on this slide is coping with malign forces was the core strategy of Jewish folk religion. It's typically the core strategy of most folk religions. And it's a pragmatic response. How do I deal with immediately what is affecting me and affecting the way I live and my health and wealth? And it's ecumenical. The Jews in the first century drew from pagan sources, and pagan sources drew from the Jews. And I'll give you some instances of that in a moment. There was no religious elite. There's no priesthood. And there's no formalized system of belief. The beliefs were sort of eclectic and catch-as-catch-can. In Jewish folk religion, they believed in unseen malign forces. And these are three quotes that I want to give you the top two you're familiar with. You've heard them all of your lives, but you probably didn't connect them to Jewish folk religion. The first one is from Ephesians. "For we are not contending against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the rulers of this present darkness, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places." The underlying portions of that quote up there are all about their belief in demonic, malign forces in the universe and the cosmos that affect them and control their lives. And the writer is saying there, of Ephesians, we're not contending against human evil. We're contending against evil that influences human beings and the powers that we have, human powers we have to deal with. And he was not alone. Earlier than that, about 60, Paul writes to the Romans, and he, in a passage you've all heard, but you probably didn't pick up on it, Paul says, "For I'm sure that neither death nor life, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor heights, nor depth, nor anything in all creation would be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord." What Paul is saying there, and you probably never understood it this way, because you've heard it in different contexts and used differently, all these demonic forces are not going to separate us from God's love. That's what he's saying. And the third quote there is from, you're probably familiar with, Jesus was accused of being possessed by Beelzebul, who was a chief in this mythology of Jewish folk religion, who was a chief of demons. They had some other chiefs, but he was one of them. And in the Talmud, do anybody know what the Talmud was or is? Okay, why don't you tell us?
Well, it's a series of teachings and talks to try to define how to live as a Jew.
That's right. And it was compiled several centuries after Jesus, but it was the first one was the Mishnah, and then the second was one of the Talmud. There was collections, as gentlemen we were saying, of teachings and debates and sayings by the Jewish sages. Anyway, Talmudic Judaism believed in a legion of demons, whose king was Ashmedai, whose queen was Igarot, and the daughter Mahalat, and who went about with a retinue of 180,000 angels of destruction. And there's a site for you if you're curious to look it up. If you can read the Talmud, it's kind of difficult to read, actually. To deal with these forces, for example, your cow gets sick. That was Chuck's example. It's a good one. How do you deal with that? Well, people in the first century devised a lot of ways to deal with it. And I'm giving you some biblical and extra-canonical sources to see this. Burning fish liver to drive out away a potentially death-dealing demon who threatened their marital bed. You remember the sermon a few weeks ago that Chuck was talking about, the passage from Luke where Jesus is asked by the Sadducees who is a wife going to be married to in the resurrection? Well, this was the passage he was referring to. Tobit had actually had the unfortunate, he talked about in the sermon, of having the death of several wives. And so when he finally marries Sarah in this passage, he wants to make sure that she's not going to die on their honeymoon. And so the way he keeps the demon, and they all believe that there was a demon that came into the marital bedroom on the honeymoon, and they had to get this demon away, they burned fish liver. Did you burn fish liver on your honeymoons? Wearing of amulets, even of idols under the clothing. That was a passage from 2 Maccabees. And it's an account about a battle in which the Jewish soldiers were killed by the Greeks. And so Judas Maccabeus takes his soldiers to go take care of the bodies of the dead soldiers, and he finds these amulets under their clothing, their tunics, of idols. And he's appalled. And so he tells his soldiers, "Let us pray for the souls of these soldiers." That is one of the core references to praying for the dead. Place an amulet around infants' heads at birth, and this is another quote from the Talmud, and women wearing amulets to cause conception. Some more references to the Mishnah Talmud are there. Those are other ways. And using ritual incantations to ward off evil spells, such as by an evil eye. And also incantation bowls to cast spells. Back in 2014, Marty and I went to Israel. And we were, one of the members of the tour decided he wanted to go with us to the old city to buy some things for some of the members of his family. He was from Virginia, member of a parish in Virginia. And he had, we were going through the old, holy old city, and there was a shop owned by the Barakat family. And that's their big clan in the Middle East. And wealthy and very influential family. And this was a beautiful shop. And we were going through, and there's some really old stuff in that shop. It went back to the Bronze Age. That's how old some of the stuff that this guy had for sale. And as I was going through, I noticed this incantation bowl. And I brought him over, I called him over, and I said, "Do you know what this is?" And he says, "No." And I said, "It's an incantation bowl." And he didn't believe me, and so I asked the guy that owned the shop, that's what it was. He said, "Yes, it is. It's a Babylonian one." Well, the Jews had them too. They're bowls just like any kind of bowl, and they had writings inside that were ritual incantations. If you wanted to put a curse on Linda here, you could use this bowl to burn incense in it, and it would put a hex on you. They use things like that. I'm trying to give you a holistic picture here, as best I can, about the world they lived in and how they believed in these demonic forces and how they tried to control them. This is another thing from the scriptures. The first one is from Mark, and you've read these scriptures before. You probably didn't pass by them and didn't understand what you were reading, actually, as evidences of Jewish folk religion. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they besought him to lay his hand on him, and taking him aside with a multitude privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and he spat, and he touched his tongue, and looked up to heaven, and he sighed, and said, Ephphatha, that is, be opened, and his ears were opened, and his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Spitting was a way, a superstitious ritual of trying to control demons and illness. The second one was Jesus is healing the man who was blind at the Pool of Siloam, a famous passage from John 9. And there, he spits on the ground, makes clay of the spittle, and anoints the man's eyes. Again, another way of doing it. Again, spitting and using spit was a way of a strong, strong way of controlling demons. They also believed that the living could intercede with God for the dead. I mentioned the Maccabean passage where they found the amulets and idols under the clothing of the dead soldiers. They also believed that their ancestors could intercede with God for the living. You are probably familiar with that, and you don't realize again that what it is. But you remember the passage, and you're going to hear it again now we're in Advent and in Christmas, about Rachel crying for her the children. You'll hear that when the Holy Infants passage in coming up in Epiphany. That's not referring to anything in Matthew that Matthew uses it for, though he uses it for that reason. What that was referring to was the Jews had this belief that Rachel, and here is her tomb, the actual tomb is on the right there, near Bethel in north of Jerusalem, that she prayed for the Jewish deportees who were being deported to Babylon in the 6th century. Rachel, the spirit of Rachel, prayed for those deportees. That was the tradition, which is in this citation I heard from the Genesis Rabbah. Right there. These tombs, this is the one on the left in Bethlehem, in the outskirts of Bethlehem. The other one is, as I said, near Bethel. That's probably on the right, the actual tomb. The biblical writers in the 6th century B.C. got this confused because the names of the two places are so similar, they thought that the location where the actual tomb is was referring to the place in Bethlehem. So that's why we have the tomb on the left is a famous tomb and the tomb that everybody goes to, but they don't know about this ruin near Bethel. A part of this was also consulting the dead. These are actual sites from the Old Testament for that. And holding feasts for the dead. The latter one, holding feasts for the dead ancestors, was common. Romans did it. That's nothing unique to the Jews, but it's part of their folk religion. And still in some cultures, like the time I spent in the Philippines in the 60s, the Filipinos still remember on death anniversaries their dead ancestors. They call it death anniversaries. This particular situation, David pulled away from and Saul was inquiring where David was, and Jonathan tells Saul, David has gone home to Bethlehem because his brother has called him back for the feast of their ancestors. The picture on the right is actually the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron. In the West Bank. That tomb and that structure there is over 2,000 years old. Herod the Great built it. And this is a good example of, can you see it?
No, I just asked her if she'd been to it.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. This is a good example of the use of, as I ask them again, if you prayed at President Kennedy's tomb, this was a pilgrimage site, and still is. In the first century, it was a pilgrimage site for the Jews who would go there to pray to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Sarah, who were supposedly buried there. They've done archaeology, have not found any remains of anybody, but that doesn't mean they weren't buried there. It simply means that the remains, when you're talking about something buried in the Bronze Age, 3,500 years ago, the remains may not be there. But this is a site where they were traditionally buried, and it was a site where Jews went. And after the Jews, Christians, and after the Christians, Muslims, and so all three go there as we speak to pray. And there's graffiti around this tomb asking for certain kinds of prayers, particularly for conception, difficult pregnancies. And that's important because that's what we're going to get into with Mary. The term I want to mention, that Aliyah L'Regel, is a specific term that the Jews used for specifically religious pilgrimages of that sort. They also made pilgrimages to sacred springs or healing springs, like the Pool of Siloam, Bethesda, both in Jerusalem, and to Caesarea Philippi. Do you remember Jesus going to Caesarea Philippi with his disciples before Peter's confession and before he says, if you're going to be my follower, you have to give up everything, forsake everything, and follow me. They were there when that happened. I don't know why Jesus took them there. That was a pagan site. But Jews used it. In fact, a Jewish king improved it, and I think probably because it was a way of making money and for his revenue. But this is a picture I took when Marty and I went there. That cave in the background is where the spring comes out for the healing spring, and it has been referred to as the gates of hell or the gates of Hades, which is what Jesus refers to. Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. He was referring to that cave. Importantly, early believers continued these folk practices. They didn't stop when they became Christians or became associated with the Christian movement. They continued. And they grafted the apostles' teaching, which at that point, which Bible scholars call a kerygma. The kerygma was, which means proclamation in Greek, the kerygma was basically, Jesus is coming back, get prepared for it, and we're going to hear those scriptures. We heard some of them today in the Advent 1 passages. Jesus is coming back, get prepared for it. He's going to come back, and you better be ready for it. That was the Matthew's passage, basically. That was the kerygma. So that didn't really help people who had health problems, people who were mentally ill, people who were disabled, people whose cow died for some reason, or whose sheep died, or camel died. So people were actually grafting folk religion at that time onto the apostles' teaching about the kerygma. So before Mary's death, this kind of answers the questions I raised to begin with. Before her death, she was honored as a matron and mentor of the Jewish community of believers, and that's referred to in Acts 1:14. She was approachable in a way that probably the male leaders of that community were not approached, particularly, and I think every woman here is going to be sympathetic to this, if you were pregnant and you're having a difficult pregnancy, who would you go to? You wouldn't go to a male leader in the community, would you? Carol's laughing. Would you have Carol?
Probably not.
And they didn't either. They would go to Mary. They went to Mary because she was Jesus' mother. And she had great rapport because the followers, particularly the women, could identify with her. Particularly with the questions around Jesus' birth. And I'll get into that in just a minute. And they saw her blessings. Now, after her death, this continued in a lot of ways. She became the object of veneration. Remember I said Jews in the first century, part of folk religion, they prayed to their dead relatives. They sought their dead relatives' advice. They sought their dead relatives. They prayed for their dead relatives, like in Maccabees when they prayed for the soldiers who had the amulets on their bodies. It was not hard to simply transfer that to Mary. When Mary died, they began to pray to her and pray for her. And because she was approachable in life, and there was rapport with Mary, because of her own life experience, that added simply to the encouragement, particularly for women. And right now, I wish we had the time in this year to go into it. I have done a lecture on Islam and Mary. You probably don't know that there are more references to Mary in the Quran than there are in the New Testament. Muslims like to make that point if you talk to them about Mary. But during the Iraqi war, the second war, there were items on the news about young Iraqi women who were pregnant going to the churches. These were Muslim women, and praying to Mary. Now that might raise your eyebrows, but that's common across all the Middle East, where Muslim women will go to these sacred sites, the Christian sites, particularly like there's a site in Damascus that's famous site to pray for Mary's intercession. And they would go there and pray during the war because they were afraid of what was happening, and they were afraid because they were pregnant, and they would pray for her intercession. Muslim women praying for Mary's intercession. That was a practice for the first roughly 70, 60 years after the church began around 30. For the next 40 years, the practice of that relationship to Mary, and Mary as a source of comfort, intercession, continued until Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans in 70. And then there's a major shift. Two Jewish sects left standing at that point are the Christian movement and the Pharisees. And the Pharisees begin a campaign, well, they're given power basically by the Romans to run Jewish affairs. And they begin to try to kick the Christians out of all the synagogues and to declare Christians as heretics. That's why you get the anti-Semitic passages in Matthew and Luke, is because of that they were written in this period, and in John also. They also begin to attack the faith via Mary by denigrating Mary's sexual purity and Jesus' legitimacy. So you're a Christian, a Jewish Christian, and you are attacked by another Jew who is not a Christian, doesn't believe in this Jesus Messiah business, doesn't believe Jesus is coming again, and this person's a Pharisee. How do you defend when they say, yeah, your so-called Messiah was a bastard and his mother was a whore? How do you defend against that? That is a very difficult thing to defend against. Well, the early Christians at that point began to look back on all the stories that they had that were folklore and legends about the Holy Family. And through those, they began to develop a chorus of stories that said, wait a minute, this is really what happened. Mary, and you know the stories, they're the Christmas stories, the stories of Mary's Annunciation, and I just read the collect for that. The Annunciation, the angel comes to Mary, Gabriel comes to Mary and says, you're going to be impregnated by the Holy Spirit. Now that was not unusual in that time, because there were a bunch of pagan kings that were supposedly their mothers were impregnated by a god. So it wasn't unusual in their context to think of that as a defense. So that story, by the way, is a way of dealing with Mary's integrity. The reason I can say that is because of these, among the many extra-canonical writings about the Holy Family, therefore hear. The first three on the top there were written down about the middle of the second century, and you probably have not heard of most of those. Maybe some of you have. The Protoevangelium of Jacobi, or James, is a parallel, or a, not parallel really, but it's an account similar to the account in Luke's Gospel about Jesus' birth and about Mary. And it is a variant tradition. It's a different tradition from the tradition in Luke, because Jesus is not born in a manger, he's born in a cave in this passage. And my point is, these were stories that were collected in the second century to defend against, they were already circulating among Christian communities. And they were collected in the second century as defensive means against the attacks of the integrity of the faith by attacking Jesus as a bastard and Mary as a whore. Just covered that. But I want to make the point here, the title is Emergence of Dogma. That's where the dogma about Mary begins, and we just said it in the creed, born of the Virgin Mary. You're quiet. You said in the creed, the dogma of Mary, that Jesus was born of a virgin, comes from these stories. Comes from the period when the church was trying to defend itself against, defend Mary's integrity, because if they didn't, the movement would have died. And so from that comes the first doctrine is Mary's virginity. You know, the first title under the title Official Church used themes in Mary folk tales originally told to entertain and cultivate Christian virtues. These stories that were circulating were told for entertainment, but they're also told like other stories were told, like for example the Odyssey and the Iliad. They were told as a way of cultivating a certain ethos. For the Greeks, those two tales by Homer were very important in developing what it was to be Greek. And so the stories of the Christians told were told for the same reason. They were a way of developing who a Christian should be and what a Christian was and what it meant to be a Christian. They weren't just necessarily entertainment. They were entertaining, but they were told for a purpose. And out of those, of course, comes the doctrine, one of the first doctrines of Mary as a virgin, when she bore Jesus. So out of those stories, Mary wasn't a fallen woman, but she conceived Jesus while a virgin. Virgin birth. Now, however you think about that, you probably have questions about the second one, is her perpetual virginity. And that's in that story document that I mentioned, this document here, the Protoevangelium of Jacobi. That particular document was probably one of the first written documents or written evidence we have of the attempt to define her perpetual virginity. Also, her Immaculate Conception, there are traces of that doctrine there. Those are not in the creed, but they are imparted to Catholics and Orthodox Christians. In fact, they are dogmatically imposed upon them. They have to believe it. Perpetual virginity simply means that she remained a virgin after Jesus' birth, was not sexually intimate with Joseph or any other man, for that matter, after Jesus' birth. Interestingly enough, I'm looking at Ellen. Anyway, I won't call it. How many of you have ever been members of Presbyterian Church? Okay. In the Constitution of the Presbyterian Church, there is a confession called the Second Helvetic Confession. And in that confession, that is referred to as ever Virgin Mary. And it is part of the dogmatic tradition for Presbyterians. But you ask a Presbyterian that, they don't know about that. They would deny it. But it's in their constitutional tradition. Part of their constitutional doctrine. Perpetual virginity. Yes, ma'am.
Can you help us understand why this was so important? Because it's done so much damage over the centuries. Why is virginity and perpetual virginity so important in that?
Because, that's what I was saying, for the early church, if they didn't respond to the claims that Mary was a whore, it undermined the entire integrity of the Christian movement.
But why did you have to be a perpetual virgin in order to not be a whore? I guess that's...
That's a good question. The best I can say to that... That's a very good question. The best I can say to answer that for you is that in the first century, that type of sexual purity was very important for a woman. From a man's standpoint, for a woman. And so all this was men arguing this. It wasn't women. The women were going to pray to Mary. They weren't worried about these doctrines. Yes, Connor?
Sorry.
Let me answer this first.
For those who really strongly believe in the perpetual virginity, how do they explain Jesus' brothers and sisters?
Okay, it's a good question. Well, that began very early on. In fact, in these documents that I listed for you, they wrestled with that question. And the best way they did it was they were not his brothers and sisters biologically. They were his cousins. Because in the first century, it was also not unusual for them to refer to cousins as brothers. It's not unusual in other cultures. I bet you that in Africa they do that, don't they, Tom? So, in the first century, that's where they answered the question. You know, it's not persuasive to us because we're so influenced by Protestantism, but that's how they answered it. You asked a question.
I think she did. Oh, it was the same question.
Okay.
How did they explain the brothers?
The last one, which was hinted at in the Protoevangelium of Jacobi, was the Immaculate Conception. And this was that Mary's mother, traditionally Anna, bore her without the taint of sin. Now, several centuries later, Augustine takes that up and says that was the taint of original sin, because he's actually the father of our understanding of original sin. So that's where the doctrine of Immaculate Conception comes from. And there are churches here in Austin, Catholic churches, called the Church of the Immaculate Conception. That's what it's all about. So these folk tales, these stories that Christians were telling about the Holy Family, to sum all this up, evolved into these formal dogmas. The official church basically absorbs these and turns them into these dogmas. Before that, they hadn't been. They'd been stories, and they were stories told to defend the faith. Now they become dogma. So here we are. The apostles' teachings were grafted on to pre-existing Jewish folk traditions and folk religious practices. Mary was likely honored as a matron of the community, and before she died, and became the object of intercessory prayers after she died. And then, stimulated by the Pharisees and pagan attacks, the folklore about Jesus' birth becomes the origin of dogma about Mary and the Holy Family. Thank you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.